Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Well, one thing that I've always wanted to do is to follow the pathways of some of the great trips through North Carolina, like Bartram's visit to, and like Inman's visit after he left the Civil War from Raleigh all the way to the mountains. And then another one that intrigues me is the travel of George Washington during his tour of the South when he was president. And I've got somebody who's the expert on that tour to come talk to all of us about George Washington's travel through the South. Warren Bingham, you've been talking and plotting and planning and traveling for many, many years about this trip. Tell us how you got interested and how you happened to turn it into a book.
Well, that's true, D.G. I first learned of this subject, it came to my mind anyway, as a senior here at UNC Chapel Hill, sitting in the class with William Powell, Bill Powell, the renowned North Carolina history professor. And Mr. Powell gave us several anecdotes about Washington's visit to North Carolina, and it really resonated. I was seated in Greenlaw Hall in a windowless classroom, and Mr. Powell got my attention that particular day. And he in particular mentioned Salisbury, and I grew up in Albemarle and Mount Gilead and not that far from there. And that, you know, really got me. I said, wow, George Washington was in Salisbury. And at that time, that was one of those, when you grew up somewhere like Mount Gilead, on Sunday afternoons back in the 60s, early 70s, you would take these drives with your family to places within 50 miles. At least my family did, and I think many did that. And Salisbury was a destination, and I enjoyed going over there. And I said, you know, wow, George Washington was in Salisbury. And from that moment forward, I always was intrigued with that trip myself, as you mentioned you are. And I wanted to start giving public talks on history subjects a few years after that. And I decided to research that topic. And that was probably in the late 80s, actually. And by the early 90s, I did start giving talks on George Washington's Southern tour, mostly in North Carolina, with an emphasis on where he was in North Carolina and why he was making this trip and so forth. Over the years, I've expanded and been in any number of states doing this. But it's just a lot of fun. And it's a way for me to make George Washington, who I think is the greatest president, definitely the most important president, to come alive.
Tell us about, or put this trip in context. When did it happen? What was going on in George Washington's life at the time he all of a sudden decided to take off and take a trip through the South?
Washington was inaugurated in the spring of 1789, D.G., as the first president under the new Constitution. Immediately, he started thinking of things he might should do as this in this new role, in this position that no one had ever been in before. And he came up with the notion that he should visit the 13 states. He thought that it would be good to be seen as the leader of the government. And he also thought he needed to just get out with the people and get ideas from them and gradually also see how they're feeling about the new government and his role as president. He wanted to get out there. He wanted to take the government to them. He wanted to kind of take this role and go out and about and not hide in an office. And he did, you know, he wanted to be transparent in that sense, as best we know it for the 1790s. And unlike, you know, even John Adams, president number two, he didn't travel around much at all. It was a different sort of style that he had. Now, granted, Washington liked to get out and about, period, because he was an outdoorsman, a farmer, a surveyor, a soldier, and so forth. So this fit his style, too. But I think he was keen that it would help unite the country, as he knew he was the hero of the Revolution, if he were out there among the people and carrying the flag of the new government out to them. So in 1791, he made what was called the Southern Tour. He essentially made three primary tours to cover the 13 states, and the Southern Tour was the last one in the spring of 1791. It took him 3.5 months. The capital was in Philadelphia still at that time. He left Philadelphia on March 21, 1791, didn't get back until July the 6th. He did get to stop at Mount Vernon, coming and going for a week or so, and that was important to him because he really didn't get to Mount Vernon a lot either as Revolutionary War general or as president of the United States. So he always relished an opportunity to get to Mount Vernon.
Had George Washington, before this tour, had he ever been to North Carolina before?
His only time in North Carolina would have been in the 1760s as a much younger man in the Dismal Swamp up in the northeastern part of the state. We don't know exactly where he was in the Dismal Swamp. He definitely was in the swamp, but there was a large section, of course, in Virginia, too.
What was he doing up there?
Well, as I recall, I believe he actually did own land in the swamp, and he also was one of the investors in a canal that was going to run from the North Carolina section, perhaps near present-day Elizabeth City, up to connect to the Elizabeth River in Virginia to take goods to sea, to the port up in the Norfolk area. And so he was down doing some surveying and looking over things. I've always heard a rumor that he had some wood and cedar shakes and things from the Dismal Swamp that might have come from North Carolina that went up to some buildings on the plantation in Mount Vernon, but I can't verify that.
Well, the interesting thing is, to me, thinking about current presidential campaigns and candidacies where the candidates light on an airplane and go across the country, and it's not unusual for the president to have been to all the 50 states now.
Right.
But back then, getting around was not all that easy, and Washington really had no idea about what was going on much south of Mount Vernon. I mean, he had not been in North Carolina except for this Dismal Swamp experience, or in South Carolina, or in Georgia.
That's true. It was all new to him, DG. He did converse and correspond with people that he knew from the Carolinas and Georgia, where he also went to Savannah and Augusta on this trip, to find out what some of the best routes were, what some of the best inns might be. He also asked about people he might should try to see or places to see and so forth. One thing I haven't mentioned is he thought it important on this trip to get to Charleston, South Carolina. Charleston was the fourth largest city in the country in the 1790 census, with a little over 16,000 souls in it, nearly half of them African American, however. So nonetheless, it was a large city for the time and a bustling place. It was behind only Boston, New York, and Philadelphia. So Washington felt, well, if I'm going to the South, and he knew a lot of thought leaders were certainly in Charleston, and a lot of, as I call it, influence and affluence were in Charleston. So he wanted to get to Charleston. That said, he wanted a representative trip through the other states. So he did not get to some places that people sometimes assume he would, such as Edenton up in northeastern North Carolina was one of our most prominent places, or his namesake town of Washington, NC, didn't make it there. So he was looking for a little bit more direct routes and easier routes and places to stay, et cetera, helped determine a little bit about his route.
So he didn't have any particular places in North Carolina he wanted to see? Wilmington?
Yeah. Well, he certainly loved seeing Wilmington, but I can't say from what I've seen in the documentation that there were any places in particular that he did want to see in the state. There may have been that I can't determine, but he wanted a representative visit to these southern states. He certainly got it by essentially taking a fall line coastal plain type route south from Philadelphia and then coming north through the Piedmont. Didn't really see the Blue Ridge region of the South.
We're visiting with Warren Bingham about his new book on Washington's Southern tour, or 1791 Southern tour. He and I are going to take a break, and we'll be right back to talk some about the specific places that Washington visited. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Warren Bingham. Warren is a longtime good friend and now the author of something he's been talking about all the time that I've known him. And the book is called George Washington's 1791 Southern Tour, and it's a book published by the History Press out of Charleston. You have just talked to us a little bit about Washington wanting to go visit Charleston, and so you wound up wanting to go visit Charleston to get those people to publish your book, I guess.
That's kind of a fun coincidence entirely, but that's right. It feels right.
When Washington started out from Philadelphia, the temporary capital of the United States, and he made his way to Mount Vernon, visited in Virginia. I want to talk about the stops he made in North Carolina, but Washington, D.C. wasn't in existence, but it was in imagination. I mean, Washington had, he was getting his colleagues in government to agree to make the permanent capital of the United States just outside his farm.
That's true. That's right. And DG, on this very trip, Congress had put in place enough things to enable Washington to go ahead and finalize a new federal capital on the Potomac. They left it sort of to a spot that he chose between an area of present-day Washington, D.C., and the falls. I don't know how many miles to the west. You have some
on the Potomac River.
On the Potomac, but all on the Potomac. And so Washington could have probably gone 30, 40, 50 miles to the west, is my impression, on selecting a site. A group of commissioners had been selected to help lay out the federal district and work on the development of same, but the CEO of the project would be the President of the United States, George Washington. So on this very trip, Washington stopped and in the Georgetown, Maryland. That was spelled with two words back then, Georgetown, Maryland, and adjacent Carrollsburg, Maryland, which really don't hear much of that term, but we all know Georgetown of D.C. These days. And Washington stopped there, met with the commissioners and all the local landowners and folks who lived around there. And they were typical Americans already. They said, well, if you're going to put the capital somewhere near here and you want some of our land, what's in it for us? That's the gist of what was going on. And there was a lot of uproar, confusion, controversy, and so forth. I guess even the eminent domain issue may have been coming up and so forth. And I'm not sure who all developed the idea, but more or less what happened is that the local landowners, where the capital finally was placed, had to give up part of their land, give away part of their land to the federal government, and also would sell part of their land to the federal government. And then another third of the idea there was that, hey, the land that you remain owning, so we won't take all your land, will now be worth a whole lot more because of this development that we're bringing to it. So it was like, hey, you got to give us some, we'll pay you for some, and then the land that we'll leave you with is going to be valuable. And so that was the concept in general that Washington was selling. He left, let me back up and just say, he literally, as the old surveyor, working with Pierre L'Enfant, we know that name as the one that had been hired as the planner, the Frenchman hired as the planner of this new federal capital, settled on the exact site on his trip down. And so they picked out the present-day site of Washington, D.C. He could have gone some miles to the west, maybe a little bit to the east. He chose this particular site. But I do remind you, this also encompassed what we now know as Alexandria, Virginia, originally. Nothing was ever developed there as far as the federal government goes. And so in the 19th century, around 1830 or 40, that was retroceded back to the Commonwealth of Virginia, and the capital's all on the north side of the Potomac. But it was there that Washington had to have a town hall meeting, I think, if you will, at Souter's Tavern in Georgetown, Maryland, and calm down folks. He left thinking, okay, they're buying into this. But as he would travel on the Southern tour, he was picking up bits and pieces that people were beginning to question the whole idea, et cetera. And Washington would more or less say, look, I'm sure Philadelphia would be happy to remain the capital if you can't come together here on the Potomac.
Well, that's an interesting story. I think maybe that'll be your second book.
Yeah, maybe so. There's a lot of threads to that.
He took off. Then from Mount Vernon, Washington was within a horseback ride. The site of the federal capital was within a reasonably easy ride, a carriage ride or horseback ride from Mount Vernon. But so he was maybe spending the nights at Mount Vernon while he was doing this.
He was not, actually.
Is that right?
He stayed at this place called Souter's Tavern, S-U-T-E-R-S. Souter's apparently was where you wanted to be if you were in Georgetown at that time. The ride to Mount Vernon, I guess, was not quite that easy. It took a few hours. And so, no, he did stay right there in Georgetown a few nights, coming and going.
And then he made his way through Virginia. And there were some interesting stops that he made in Virginia. But I want you to tell us about his North Carolina travel. When on the as he was traveling south, he crossed the border. Where did he land in North Carolina?
Well, he passed probably near the present day I-95 Welcome Center, DG. He was following the corridor today that we know as the
Like Roanoke Rapids.
That's right, U.S. 301 I-95 area. And his first stop in North Carolina was at the end of a early April stormy day. Been a very rough afternoon on him. Sounded like it was a tornadic type of weather going on.
Let me interrupt
on.
You and just yes. say, who did he have with him? And was he on it by himself riding this horse on this trip.
Right. This was not a big entourage, nothing like we think of today for presidential travel, but there was a little bit of a group with him. I believe it was a total of, by this point, seven men, and there were actually two slaves that had originally been signed on to go, but one took ill and stayed at Mount Vernon. So there was a slave kind of handling baggage and extra horses that were brought along for replacements and for to take a horse instead of a wagon or chariot from time to time. There was a chariot pulling the president, D.G., with four brown horses, a white, red, and gold chariot being pulled by four horses.
I mean, what is a chariot?
A chariot, I don't know.
What is Well, here's a buggy, or is it, what is it?
It is an enclosed carriage. It is a...
Would it look like a stagecoach?
Yes, it was a very fancy one, but yes, it would look like a stagecoach to probably what we know in our popular culture. You could equate it to that. So it was enclosed, and the only people riding in that chariot, at least at times, it was just the president, but William Jackson, who was a native of Charleston, South Carolina, and a Revolutionary War officer himself, was one of the presidential secretaries. He traveled on several of these tours with the president, including this one on the Southern tour. He was in his early 30s. So he was sort of serving as a top aide, not only the secretary, but a bit of a bodyguard, and to assist in any way he could. There were these other horses being led along. There was a baggage wagon, other horses being led along. Occasionally, everyone would get out and ride a horse as well. So they had options. A couple of times during the trip, they had to swap some horses in some communities, reshoe some horses and things like that. But generally, the horses held up pretty well. So we had a lot of horses. I think at one point, it was seven men and 11 horses all told.
So Washington might be riding in the what you call the chariot, or he might be on horseback where we would.
That's right.
And just depending on how he was feeling at that moment.
That is right.
They crossed the Virginia line, and where do they stop?
Halifax, North Carolina.
Tell us about Halifax is like Mecklenburg County is on the state flag. We have the Halifax date of the Halifax Resolves, but we don't hear too much about Halifax today.
We don't. Halifax was very prominent in the 1700s, and it was sometimes the temporary capital of the state and the colonial capital. And Halifax was already though in decline. It was a place of commerce because it was on the Roanoke River. And it was thriving in the mid-1700s, but was already declining. But it had some prominent citizens, D.G. William R. Davy, who we know for several reasons, but the founder of UNC, lived there.
Was William R. Davy there when Washington came?
I'm still trying to figure that out all these years later.
I thought he maybe moved to South Carolina at least for a while.
He was still in the state at the time. Uh-huh. I know that much. But I don't know if he was even there at that. But he still owned the house there.
One of the most interesting parts of your book that I'd kind of forgotten about is that not everybody in the country, and especially in North Carolina, was in favor of this federal government that had just been established. In fact, when we talk about our history in Hillsborough, that the first attempt to get the North Carolinians to join the new federal government, the United States of America, they turned it down. And that one of the leaders of the opposition movement was there in Halifax, Mr. Jones.
Mr. Jones.
Tell us about, did they get together? Because Jones was an opponent of
Wiley Jones is spelled like Willie, but pronounced Wiley, was a longtime prominent resident of Halifax, and he was North Carolina's leading opponent of the federal Constitution. And it helped overturn it the first time the state had voted on it. However, it obviously passed, and Jones had written somewhere that when Washington came to Halifax, he would not receive him as president of the United States, but only as a great man. This tended to tamper down enthusiasm some in Halifax with the president coming, because I think generally most people there were excited about the president coming. William R. Davy was a good friend and proponent of the Constitution and the president. He was from there. Again, I don't know if he was even there, though, at this particular time when Washington stopped. Wiley Jones was there, but I find no documentation about exactly what took place. But it is, I think, a safe assumption that Jones did meet with the president, saw the president, but we don't know what was said. But here's the kick, DG, is, you know, the president was just there for a couple of nights, a couple of days in Halifax, and folks had to live with Wiley Jones after George Washington left. So it probably honed down their enthusiasm some, because they had to deal with Wiley for the rest of their lives, and they didn't want to look too much in favor, perhaps, of the president.
Well, it's interesting because the Washington would have been a hero to people whether they went along with the idea of having one solid federal central government or not.
That's right.
So I got the feeling from reading your book that he was probably, again, trying to use the personal feelings that people would have about him to say, look, it's going to be okay to have this federal government. We're going to take good care, respect your rights and all of that, and I'm in charge, and I'm you can trust me. It was a personal view, but it was also a political view in the sense of we respect these people who opposed us, and we want to bring them around.
Well, that's exactly right. And Washington did want to convey that, and he had put forth the word that, yes, he'd be happy to meet and see any and everyone like that. I remind people all the time of this situation in that era, DG, because it seems so foreign conceptually to us now, that people were not just patriots about the new American government and the presidency. We had gone through the Revolution. That had been very divisive in many ways. Families had fought internally against one another, some supporting the crown and some supporting the patriot side and so forth. So these were uneven times. And so then once we gained independence, I think a lot of individual citizens just kind of wanted to be left alone. It was sort of a fantasy land, thinking, well, I'm just going to run my farm here and no one bothers me at all. There won't be any overarching government or anything. And that just wasn't going to be the case.
Well, if you join us late, I'm visiting with Warren Bingham. He's the author of a brand new book, George Washington's 1791 Southern Tour. He and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Warren Bingham, our good friend, very often in Chapel Hill, loved it from the time that he came here as a student. And as a student, got interested through the great teaching of Bill Powell about one item that has become Warren Bingham's sort of longtime hobby, and that is the trip that George Washington took through the South during his presidency. And Warren, when we stopped, we had just got him in North Carolina at Halifax, one of the several places that had served as North Carolina's capital. Where did he go after he left Halifax?
From D.G., he went on to Tarboro. He went to Tarboro, which still already had that wonderful town common in place that we know today. Mm-hmm. Charming place to visit. And Tarboro—
apologize. I've got me so excited about the book. But of the places that most of us have never been— Halifax is one because there's a restored, as you point out in your book, a restored area that, from which you can imagine the way it was when George Washington visited, and it's not corrupted by having a lot of skyscrapers and everything nearby.
Right.
And similarly, one of the things that every North Carolinian should do is to visit Tarboro for this wonderful town square that you mentioned, which was being developed, I guess, as George Washington came. So I'm sorry I interrupted you, but got me excited.
Well, that is one of the places that you can go there and sort of embrace the notion that, yes, I can sort of envision George Washington being here. Of course, many things from the 1800s, early 1900s there, but still, given the way we see the world now here in 2016, you go to Tarboro and say, yeah, I can imagine George Washington being here. Tarboro already had a bridge across the Tar River.
Yes.
And that was a big deal for Washington. Crossing water was a major hassle.
This was very fascinating to me. The people in Harbor had somehow got a bridge across the Tar River. And every other place, Washington and his, what you call the chariot and the horses, they had to figure out a way to ford the rivers or get across them or get a ferryman to take them across. I guess it was just you had to do those things in those days, but it looked like it would be a real problem if you didn't have a bridge.
It was a safety issue, a time issue, just a hassle and inconvenience in every which way. In fact, this is the kind of thing I remind myself of today when I'm sitting in traffic on an interstate is, hey, this is a lot easier than President Washington had crossing the Chesapeake. So keep that in mind. But yes, Tarboro had a bridge. I don't know the history of how they already had a bridge. That was pretty impressive. In fact, Washington put that in his diary that they had a bridge over the Tar. And so he thought that was a great thing. However, he did point out in the same diary entry that they only saluted him with a single cannon. And they did as good a job as they could, but still, that was not too impressive. And so Washington liked pomp and ceremony, and he was probably a little disappointed. He'd already been to Halifax, where everyone wasn't quite jumping up and down. And then he gets to Tarboro. They only had
one cannon.
So he's got to get deeper into North Carolina yet to get really happy.
Well, where did he go next?
He was on the way to New Bern, and he stopped in Greenville, which is I believe it had just been named Greenville at that time. I forget the name it had been called up before that. But he stopped in Greenville, and he saw the tar process, a tar being made for the first time there in the area. So that he liked to understand the commerce and the agriculture as he traveled. So that was an important thing to him to witness that. And from Greenville, it was on to New Bern, which was our largest town in the 1790 census. I think fewer than 3,000 people in New Bern. But it was the progressive place, the happening place, in the 1790s in North Carolina.
Did he? We have the restored Tryon Palace in New Bern today, but at some point that had fallen into disrepair and burned down. Was this the center of activity when
Washington
still was
there? Prominent and important, D.G., but he mentioned in the diary that it was already going some to ruin. But yet there was a big event held there in his honor, a dance. And this was the first of many times throughout the trip that he would note, and I think Major Jackson, his secretary, must have helped with this endeavor. But Washington would note almost to the exact number how many women were in attendance. Now, we have nothing untoward going on here about George Washington. No scandal here, but he just liked to count the women for some reason. And he was a detail kind of guy. I often tell people that. So he would say there were 65, I forget how many in New Bern. I think it was something like that, 65 lovely women in attendance. And that was just the way he saw the world and saw those dance events. There were a number of dances along the way. And the first really nice one in North Carolina was in New Bern at the Tryon Palace.
What about liquor at these events that Washington that people had for Washington? Did we have a bunch of prohibitionists back then, or did
liquor flowed freely in the colonial and early statehood era? I think alcohol maybe was flowing better than it's ever has flowed before, frankly. It seemed that was a major part of things. I find little evidence that people were concerned about it. And on this trip, oftentimes there were a number of toasts each evening. I think they would start dinner at 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon, then go into a ball, and these things would go on to midnight. And so they would have cannon salutes between toast, DG, and they would go on to often there to be at least 13 toasts to represent each state. Then there usually would be another one or two beyond that for good measure, as the expression goes. And so I conjecture in the book, I don't know about this, but I said, you know, I think this may be where the term getting blasted comes from drinking and then the cannon tributes.
Of the cannon,
right,
went along with the
right. And this was kind of a slow process, I believe.
Well, it reminds you of going to Russia during the old days, that they would try to see who could get who could drink who under the table with vodka toast and everything.
Right.
And Washington himself would have a toast. You listed in one place like 13 toasts, I guess.
Right. I do list one counting of the different toasts. They would toast to the agriculture of America. They often toasted the French because we still love the French in 1791, apparently.
It was interesting to me. This was so interesting to me that at this point, this is right at the moment that the French Revolution is getting started, and you toast the king of, they were still toasting the king of France.
Right. That's right.
And a few years later, that wouldn't be possible.
Things turned in a hurry.
That wouldn't be possible. When he left New Bern, where did he go? And did he? There's some desolate land between New Bern and Wilmington even today.
He was going to Wilmington from New Bern, and there wasn't much in between the two places. That's right. And there are some stretches today where there isn't much. And ironically, he had to go right through Jones County, which already existed by that name at that
name
time.
Named for our friend Wally Jones.
There were two living legends that I mentioned in the trip, but at least those two, George Washington and Wiley Jones. So Jones had his cohort in North Carolina that greatly favored him. And so that's very interesting. And you know, and Jones Street in Raleigh is named for Wiley Jones, laid out there when Raleigh was created in 1792. So he had to go through Jones County. Ironically, I don't really know why, but a Mr. Shine ran a tavern near present-day Trenton that was reportedly one of the finer taverns in eastern North Carolina. So Washington was at Shine, so that must have been a bit of a treat, but he didn't say much about
it. Is this in Wilmington or on the way to Wilmington?
It's on the way to Wilmington. So this is somewhere in Jones County, not far from Trenton. And then from Shine's Tavern, it got pretty rough then. And Washington wrote in his diary that this is the most barren land I've ever beheld. He was going through a lonely pine forest.
This is real interesting. You had obviously read the wonderful book, The Longleaf, because Washington did take note of these magnificent trees, but he also thought he was in a desolate place.
That's right.
But in those days, you could talk about it either way. Right now, we look back sort of wishing that we'd preserve those longleaf pine forests.
I do make a special notation in there about the longleaf pine. I personally think we need to bring a lot more back, and Washington took note of them on that trip, and I think he began to appreciate them and knew that was the foundation for the tar pitch and turpentine industry in North Carolina and lumber industry, and it would be very important if we could restore some of the longleaf pine forests. But Washington, I guess it was a bit tedious going through there. That was new to him. He had not seen such ranging expanses of longleaf pine forests. But he said it's rather pretty as well. But yet it was tedious, and he couldn't understand why there weren't more crops out there other than the longleaf pines.
Well, did he finally make it? Did he finally get to Wilmington? And if he did, what did he do there?
He arrived in Wilmington on Easter Sunday, but he mentions nothing in his writings about it being Easter, and I find no evidence that anything big was going on for Easter vis-a-vis Washington's arrival. I thought that was interesting. D.G., often throughout his trip, local militia and leaders would come out sometimes 10, 20 miles away from their base to meet the president. Not every community, the smaller ones, didn't necessarily know Washington was coming, but all the larger ones did. And so they would come and meet Washington. And so that day they met him up, I think, near Holly Ridge, which I talk about Holly Ridge in the book, near up there, what's that, near Topsail Beach in that area. And so they escorted him into town. He spent a couple nights in Wilmington. He loved looking around Wilmington. It had a population of about 1,000, and he liked to see the river commerce, and he was curious about if it could be improved and how far upstream the Cape Fear was navigable. He always wanted to push trade inland and thought that was the key to American business in the future.
Well, we're visiting with Warren Bingham. We're talking about George Washington's 1791 Southern Tour, which is the new book Warren has written. We've gone through North Carolina as President Washington traveled south. He then goes to South Carolina and Georgia. And after the break, he'll have to come back through North Carolina. We'll get Warren to tell us about that trip. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. We're talking with Warren Bingham about his book, George Washington, 1791 Southern Tour. And we're focusing on what George Washington did in 1791 in North Carolina on his trip. We got him, if you join us late, we got him through North Carolina as he went south towards South Carolina and Georgia. After his visits to Georgia and South Carolina, he had to get back to Mount Vernon. He had to come back through North Carolina again, but he took a different route. Where did he go? What places did he stop and visit when he was coming back through North Carolina?
Well, yeah, D.G., he was essentially taking a Piedmont route north, and that was true from where his furthest point south in Georgia. He was in Augusta, which was the capital of Georgia at that time, and came north up to the center part, or the Midlands, as they call it today, of South Carolina. He was in Columbia, the new state capital, and he worked his way through upcountry South Carolina, kind of near present-day Fort Mill, and came into the, I guess it's near what would be Pineville today in Mecklenburg County, and went and spent a night in Charlotte. And D.G., I know you have a long history in Charlotte and Mecklenburg County.
Well, I'm sure George Washington was thoroughly impressed. What did he have to say about Charlotte?
Well, they still talk about it in Charlotte. I've had people in the media contact me over the several years before this book came out even about it. Washington used the term trifling place to describe Charlotte in his diary. Well, it was then. It had probably 500 souls, if that many. It was the courthouse of Mecklenburg, and the courthouse literally, I find this fascinating, stood in the center of the square at Trade and Tryon Street. Here's something I just learned, and even I think after I finished writing the book, the inn where Washington stayed. He was hosted by the great uncle of future President James K. Polk. He was hosted by Thomas Polk, who lived right there in the center of town. But Washington actually stayed at Cook's Inn. And Cook's Inn is at the corner of Trade and Church Streets. And today, there's a couple of restaurants on the site, including a Hooters. So this is prominent in my thinking. Now, when I go out to give talks, I've got something new to tell people.
The Hooters are now celebrating the visit of George Washington.
That's right. George was there. But the Presbyterian, First Presbyterian of Charlotte's right across the street, so that keeps everybody straight at that particular Hooters.
That's great.
DG.
Other than calling it a trifling place, did he learn anything about Charlotte that he mentioned in his diary? And again, we have this controversy about the Mecklenburg Declaration of Independence. Thomas Polk had something to do with that that situation. No mention.
No mention of that, and I'm trying to remember if I've ever seen Washington opine. We know that Thomas Jefferson later gave an opinion on that, but I don't think I've seen George Washington comment on the Mec Dec, and so I don't know what his feelings were or what was said during that time. I should mention, too, going north on this trip, DG, Washington had kept to a schedule. He had really, he's an old soldier, you know, so he sort of put out a detailed itinerary that he always stayed within a day or two of this entire trip. Had very few mishaps. Horses generally stayed well, slowed him down a little bit occasionally. And so he was going north. He'd already been to Charleston, which was a prominent stop. He still wanted to be, I'd use the expression to see and be seen. But he was getting up and leaving at 4 a.m. oftentimes as he went north. And so that was...
He
was in a hurry. He was rolling on and had to get back to business. He also was away from the line of the mail. The mail came down the coast, down the King's Highway. So... in theory, anyway, if there was some important mail to get to the president, they might have caught up with him through Savannah. But then when he started coming north through the Piedmont, it got really dicey as to whether or not they could get a message to him, his cabinet or Vice President John Adams.
Well, you talked about your visits to Salisbury earlier in our conversation. He gets the chance to visit Salisbury on his way.
He does, and so he goes near present-day Concord and then on into Salisbury, following roughly the I-85, U.S. 29 corridor that we all know today. There's a great old story that is very controversial. It's not that important, but it's a cute little story that Washington stopped on the outskirts of Salisbury at the Brandon Estate. And there, the only one home was the little girl, Betsy Brandon. And she says, "Well, I'm so sad, sir. The whole family's gone to town. I'm the only one here to receive you." She didn't know who this man was or his entourage was. "Everyone's gone to town to see President Washington, and I'm sad they left me behind." So he said, "Well, I'll tell you what, if you can give me a hoe cake and some buttermilk," something like that, said, "I'll make sure the president sees you." And so Washington had his treat provided by Betsy, and then he said, "I sit before you as the President of the United States." And that's the old legend. Some people say it's true. Some say it's not true at all. It's a little like the Mecklenburg Declaration of Independence.
It's a great story. We just got a minute or two, and one of the places that Washington apparently really enjoyed was his visit to Salem. And this would have been pretty close to the time that he made his way back into Virginia.
So. That's true, DG. One of his last prominent stops in North Carolina was Salem. He spent 2 nights there. The jacket cover of my book shows is an artist's rendition of his arrival in Salem. Washington loved music, and the Moravians were really keen on music, and so he was serenaded both evenings in Salem, and it was there that Governor Alexander Martin, the North Carolina governor, met up with him. Washington saw the governor of all the states he passed through on the Southern tour, so Governor Martin found him in Salem. And so, yes, he very much enjoyed his time in Salem and was impressed by their industry, and also the fact that they had a waterworks. If you know Spring Street on I-40 business, you'll see a Spring Street exit. Well, that spring that is referring to was what fed the original Salem, and they tapped into it and distributed water throughout the little village. And Washington was impressed by that.
We've got General Washington, our President Washington, on the edge of the Virginia line. Did any have any other little adventure before he crossed back into Virginia?
Well, he worked his way up through Rockingham County, and then he went a little bit back to the east, just south of Danville, Virginia, but stayed his last night in North Carolina at a Mr. Dudley Gatewood's house. Mr. Gatewood must have been one of the kind back then that just took in travelers, but it was not an inn or anything. Here's an interesting tidbit. That was his last night in North Carolina. I assumed the Dudley Gatewood house was long gone. For many years, I thought that. I just learned a few years ago that the house was taken apart and moved in pieces to Daniel Boone Village in Hillsboro back in the early 1970s. And today, DG, unless it's changed recently, that is a Mexican restaurant there in Daniel Boone Village off I-85 in Hillsboro.
If you want to eat where George Washington had his last meal in North Carolina, go to the Mexican restaurant.
Jorge Washington ate here. That's right. He slept there, actually. That's right.
Warren Bingham, thank you so much for your book, and thanks for taking so much time to visit with us here in Chapel Hill about George Washington, President George Washington's visit to North Carolina in 1791.
Thanks for having me, DG.
And thanks to all y'all for listening. This is DG Martin. Who's talking? I'll be back here before you know it.